It's a Monday morning, so thanks for joining on the call. So we thought we'd discuss your Temperature Life project today and your use of arts-based research. For those of you who don't know or aren't familiar with this term, arts-based research is the use of creative arts practices in research about any particular topic. It might be from social life, but it's increasingly being used in the sciences and across engineering and business world. And the people use creative arts practices, for example. It can be anything from knitting to filmmaking to soundscaping to poetry to creative arts for creative writing. So, can you tell us a little bit about your project? And if, as a scientist, you'd come across arts-based research before you started to use it in this process?
Sure, thanks, Cliff. So my I'm a climate scientist by background, and yeah, very much. I started my studies with geography, but I sort of specified into physical geography quite early on, but was based in a geography department. So you've got cultural geographers and social scientists, like quite a broad spectrum within the subject. So I suppose I'd kind of been exposed maybe to like little crumbs here and there that, this was a way that people might do research, but I'd never really given it a huge lot of thought myself. So the project Temperature Life Stories that we ran, I was interested in how an individual would experience temperature extremes, because my day-to-day sort of climate science work is all thinking about temperature extremes and, how do we classify something as extreme or not extreme is kind of quite fundamental importance when we want to figure out if extremes are changing in the future with climate change. But that threshold of what is extreme or not extreme is going to be different for every single person, because some people maybe grew up in a warm place, some people grew up in a cold place, some people might have a medical condition, which means that they can't tolerate high heat, or they might live in a house which is not well adapted to high heat. So there's all these different individual factors that are important. And so I thought it'd be interesting to produce a life graph of temperature for individual participants who got involved. And so they would see how the temperature had varied in the place that they had lived throughout their entire life. And they'd get a little graph for them for their own life. And then to kind of bounce off that, I wanted to do something creative. So I spoke to a few people in the university and was suggested, when you think about working with Caleb Parkin, who's a poet, and people could articulate their experiences of temperature through poetry, and then we could compare the graphs and the poetry and see if the two matched up. And if people remembered the hottest bit of their life, I put hottest in inverted commas, hottest according to the climate data, does that actually match up with their memories, what they think they experience, what stands out to them as the hottest day? Because it struck me that there were certain days that I remember feeling very hot and like warm and uncomfortable in my own life. But they were generally days when I was like stuck in a sweaty office or something in Bristol. And it was hot for Bristol, but technically it wasn't as hot as, say, days I'd been on holiday. But when I was on holiday, I was kind of prepared for it. I was maybe on a beach and, I was dressed for the occasion and mentally prepared. Whereas when I was just trying to get my work done in a hot office in Bristol, it was really uncomfortable and grim. So yeah, this is the sort of thing that I wanted to explore, and I think we did a pretty good exploration of it. We had lots of really interesting ideas came out through the project.
So it sounds like temperature became about stories too. For example, often when we think about temperature, people, as you were sort of alluding to there, sort of temperature is often associated with data. And while we read data in our own way, but data in itself tells its own stories. But also when they speak their own, I guess, none, for lack of a better term, sort of a more mundane or everyday data, they speak it through particular stories. Like they might say the temperature, the exact temperature, like it's 30 degrees or whatever Celsius. But then they'll go into a more, oh, it was really sticky, or, you know, or we didn't walk here for this reason because it was too hot to walk that far, so we stayed in this place. And other people pick up on these signals and they, you know, so it is a form of data sharing in the everyday. And I think what you're pointing towards is, you know, to get at that sort of storytelling and this different ways people want to express themselves about temperature and data and their own forms of data. This is what the arts-based research can enable you to do. But one of the things when you're doing arts-based research, and I find this myself, is about, it's a question of how much control do you put on the process? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes it can be a case of, okay, here's free rein. Just go for it. Create something.
Yeah.
Sometimes that works. Then other times people are like, oh, give me some more guidance. Pin it down a little bit. Give me more, some more structure. So what did you do? How much structure did you offer compared to how much freedom, and how did you plan that in to the process?
That's a good question. So I would agree on this kind of, it was a project about stories. And I suppose what I had envisaged at the start was that everyone would tell a story, like one particular narrative about one particular event, like top to bottom, and that would be it, and it would compare to some point in their life graph. But really, I think in some cases that did happen, but in other cases it was like people brought maybe you could describe them as micro stories to the event, and it was like little tiny insights into the day. I think it was, you know, particularly because the way the project started, the first poetry exercise we did was called I Remember. And Caleb got everybody to just use that. I remember, dot, dot, dot. And then you had to add something related to hot or cold temperatures afterwards and just let everything kind of spill out from your memory and your mind. And some of the things that came up were so graphic, and you could just put yourself back there, whether that was, you know, like a scene that you could see or smells or sensations. And there were all these little tiny little details, these little golden nuggets that, you know, would be the sort of thing that would elevate a whole other story. So you could have had one long narrative and it would be this one tiny detail that just makes the story complete. And actually we basically just fast tracked straight to that, and they all just came spilling out right at the very start, which I thought was amazing seeing, and I really would count that as data, as you say, a very, very different kind of data to what I was used to. But I think that was a great way to start the workshops off. And then in terms of the control, as you say, you know, so I'd already come in with this idea that people would have a very sort of complete single story. And really it was an awful lot more kind of scattered and all over the place, but we gave people, I suppose, the skills in poetry, because that's what Caleb was kind of coaching people in. But we did say to them, like, we want to do an exhibition at the end of three workshops and bring whatever you want in whatever format you want, whatever works for you. And so yeah, we did three workshops. Two were kind of actual training, and the final one was the exhibition. And at the end of the second training workshop, we did graph jamming, we called it, where people were encouraged to think about how could they reinterpret their graph, like what creative method could they use, you know, could it be turned into a flower bed or a stained graph window, a stained glass window made out of their graph, or, you know, whatever. And people started bouncing off these mad ideas, and I was like, oh, that's crazy. Oh, you couldn't do that. Oh, that's just too mad. A soap opera or a docudrama or a this or a that or a an aerial silk show, like acrobatic show. It's like, this is all crazy stuff. Like, people couldn't actually do this. And then they went away for 2 weeks and they came back, and some of them had actually done these mental ideas that they'd said about it. I just thought, that's not possible. That's too creative. But actually, it really, really worked. So I think one of the things that was good about the project was the, well, first of all, I think it's, you know, you need to have a good level of trust within the group to do that. And I think the group size was quite good. But yeah, I believe that Caleb made a really good kind of environment that people felt safe to try these things out. And it's, you know, it's not the first workshop I've been in where it's felt like a safe space, but I feel like it's really essential to have that kind of safe space feeling for these to be as productive and creative as they can be. And then secondly was just the timing of the workshop. So we did, say we did three, so we did one, then we left a week, then we did the second, and then we left a 2 week gap with an optional like one-to-one drop in. And so it was enough time to give people a chance to, if they were going to actually create something like a piece of artwork or a musical piece or whatever, it gave them 2 weeks to go away and compose that, but not so long that they kind of lost interest and lost momentum with it. Just sort of kept things going at a steady rhythm. And that, I think that was really good, because if we'd just done a 1 day workshop, full day workshop, say, people would have come up with all these great ideas, but not necessarily have had space to build upon them. So yeah, I think it was, that was good. And I would definitely want to do that again, I think, in the future, if possible.
I quite like this idea of, it is a fine balance, isn't it? Like it's what I understand there is you have to come in with, you have a goal. It's a flexible goal. You have quite clear research questions you want to address that you will revisit, of course, depending on what the participants bring. But then giving them, you're not, because people obviously got their own creative skills and they want to use them. So I think the most important thing coming out of that is Caleb and yourself, you spoke about a space of safety, confidence, building, support. If they felt like they needed some skills, you could offer them those skills. So in some ways, you're sort of, it's like a more nurturing environment rather than an extractive environment. Often when we do data collection, it can sometimes feel to me, particularly when people use some more traditional Western approaches to this, be it in the social sciences or even the sciences, feels like you're extracting something from the community. But what you've given them is a chance to grow and create data alongside you and to make it and see this being made use of collaboratively. Because often too, when people participate in research projects, the research project goes off and does something and they're left often, you know, it is good practice to go back to them, but you know, with a scientific paper, some people might be interested, some people far less interested, but this is a sort of opportunity for them to say, oh, I made a contribution to knowledge as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really powerful outcome of using this sort of arts-based research and creative research. But it sort of does raise an interesting question for me when we think about authorship and ownership of research. Mm-hmm. And the way the universities structure that. So when you think about this project now going forward,
yeah,
you know, these participants have given, sort of handed over this and handed over this important data or helped you find data, these gold nuggets.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, do you think the university setting, the publishing, academic publishing needs to start making some shifts here into, okay, how do we accommodate different modes of authorship, different modes of ownership of this data, etc.? Has that come up in your thinking at all?
That is a good question. I feel like that I haven't given that a huge amount of thought to this point. It's probably sort of the next step. I keep doing this kind of research in the future, it's the next thing I'll probably have to really think about and come to terms with. Because I would say this whole project, I didn't know what to expect really going into it, because I've never done this kind of research in this kind of way using these methods before. And so much of it was new, you know, as a physical climate scientist, the first time I've ever had to do an ethics form, because, you know, if you're just studying climate model data, it's not seen as having, you know, feelings and emotions that you could hurt, so you can abuse the data in whatever way you want. That said, you know, it's quite interesting thinking about the point of doing the climate science on this model data is to think about making informed societal decisions about what we're going to do with in a changing climate. And actually there is an ethical side to that, which I feel like that the fact that I'd never experienced an ethics form or had to think about that at all as a physical scientist is quite surprising, I suppose. And it wasn't as traumatic as I expected it to be. Maybe I just got lucky, but you know, I thought it was very useful to think about it. But yeah, in terms of like what happens next with the research, as I say, because I'm new to this, I didn't really envisage before I started that I would actually count this as data and research, like what we've done so far. You know, for me, again, with quite a straightforward background in science, is like, well, you know, things are proven, you know, you prove that you've done research by having a publication, or that your name at the very least has been cited in some sort of like policy report. That would also count as, even if it's not an academic publication. And I do sort of, doing this project has made me like reassess like what actually is research? Like is research useful if it can be used by society at large, you know, and it informs some sort of policy? Or is research about me as the researcher having a shift in my own thoughts and my own views, which will then kind of just trickle into my worldview, which will then go into future publications and reports and, you know, feed into the wider university thinking, because I'm part of the university community. And I think that's kind of where I'm at now, is I've realized that actually, yeah, that's what research is about. And the common format as a scientist is to write a paper, because that informs my viewpoint. I kind of convince myself in the form of writing that what I've thought makes sense. But actually, there's lots of ways I can change my viewpoint. And then I'll go out and have conversations with my colleagues in geography or elsewhere in the uni or other universities, kind of based upon those little golden nuggets. And then that in itself counts as work, as research, you know. But yeah, so how that would in the future make it into a publication, for example, that people need credited for, I'm not really sure. At the moment, I just feel like I was in that group of participants. I was a participant as much as the others were, and we all kind of learned together. And I guess I'm just more likely to be in a situation in the future, potentially, than some of the other participants, where I'll actually have to like talk about it and kind of process what the bigger picture was from all of those little nuggets and stories that people brought to the workshop.
But I love that. I love that idea that the methodology itself is a learning experience for everyone involved. Yeah, it's not just a step on the way to achieving this. It's that process is crucial. And I do think it, you know, you're already doing it in terms of, you know, you're showing people's work, you're building a website to show the contributions to knowledge, and you're valuing those contributions to knowledge. So it's already being shared. And I think that is an acknowledgement. And often when we write papers, it's about not acknowledging, like there is examples, for example, the CLEAR Lab, in Canada, headed up by Max LeBoron, who put everyone down as co-authors. And you know, they bring a very, very different ethics to science research, and you're right. I think that this is a really crucial point. You're unpacking this whole ethics. There still is a strong tradition of things need to be, you know, the data needs to be generalizable. But sometimes it's not just the data, it's the experience. And you can say, well, in this different setting, we can use some of the same principles to work out, well, okay, what's the situated knowledge and experience in this place compared to this place and compared to this place, without getting to some such an abstraction where it becomes so objective and divorced from everyday, the messiness of everyday life. That's when it starts to, as an outsider, it can start to feel meaningless to us, right? Like we can sort of say, well, you keep showing us the data, but you've abstracted this to the point that, and then you're trying to come back to us and trying to say, well, we need artists to show us how to communicate back to the public, whereas the public is sort of like, yeah, we were out there at the start. You just left us off the train. Our ticket's expired here. The train kept going. And that's what that's what I like about this project, is you've taken people right through the whole journey with you. That's why I like it as a model. I think it's worked out a lovely model. And that's credit to the way both you and Alan, yourself and Caleb have run this. This project. So in terms of advice going forward, I know you haven't done a lot of this work, but in terms of advice, you know, do you think the smaller size, the dipping your toe into the water, is a good way to approach this, or just go for it and you know, work through the challenges? Working through the challenges is part of the process.
Yeah, I guess we had a similar kind of question to this when we did the Breakthrough workshop, kind of Q&A seminar thing last week. I would say that starting small-ish, like something can be too small. If it's too small, you can't actually afford to, you know, pay someone like Caleb to facilitate it. Well, it's quite hard to do it without bringing in expertise of people who have got experience in this sort of field of work before. But that said, I wouldn't have wanted it to be too big. Like, it's quite nice to start small, like for someone like myself who is new to the field, because if I had been given, I don't know, £100,000, I'd have just been, my mind would be blown. I wouldn't know how to build on this further and where to go next, and there would be too many options. It's quite nice to have that sort of small to medium sized funding pot for something like this. It just means that, you know, you've got one set of workshops, and I don't know how much of the success of the project really came down to the luck of the participants who came along. Like, you know, if we've got a different bunch of people who just didn't really click with each other or were very sort of disinterested, the whole thing might have just been a bit like, yeah, it was an interesting experiment, but, you know, I wouldn't do it again. Whereas I loved it. I thought it was really, really good. But it's a gamble. And so I think for me, that was kind of the perfect size of a project and the perfect length as well, because, you know, I couldn't have like justified costing in my own time without knowing that it was going to be a useful experience. And I didn't know before I'd started. So if I had said I'm going to run 100 workshops, I never would have got my other job done alongside it. So definitely. I thought it was good just to have that little small kind of pilot project, which actually I think was more than just a pilot project. I think it really generated stuff. It wasn't just like proof of concept. So I would encourage other people like myself from the physical sciences just to try it for that little, you know, say 1 month, 2 month period, just to see what it's like. But yeah, I think it's something which requires, definitely, besides just the money and the practicalities of running it, and like, you know, the space and time from your supervisory team to be like, yeah, it's okay for you to do arts-based research for, you know, a month. It does require definitely a very open mind, I think, going into it, because I'm not saying that every scientist has to do it. I don't think that's how it works. The same way, not every artist should have to interact with the sciences. Like, there's always going to be a spectrum of how people understand and see the world. But it's also really important that there's some people who kind of bridge the gap between all the different, you know, whatever way you want to describe it, like spokes of the wheel that you can go out on. And so, yeah, I think it's exciting because, you know, as a researcher, I'm curious. I'm sure most other researchers would describe themselves as curious. So why not try something different? But I think you have to already have a bit of love of the arts. And if you're, you know, if your one true passion in life is computer coding and data and nothing else, fine, great. You code and code and code and make all the code better and more efficient. And that's fantastic. But if you just sort of think that, I wonder what those cultural geographers are really doing. You're sitting in the coffee room in geography, looking across the room at them, thinking, what are they talking about? Then just go out and try it. It's good fun, in my opinion.
So, and, you know, and it works the other way. Sort of people coming out of the arts, there's a lot of artists and a lot of people who, you know, you talk about those who are just truly passionate about, say, coding. And that is almost becomes their creative means and through that approach. But there's lots of artists who'd love to learn that too, right? Like, it's not just one way traffic here, and to sort of say, right, I'd love to work with that person because I want to do coding and I want to go down that way and I want to know what they're doing, how they're arriving at what they're doing. And so, yeah, it is that conversation, and conversations can go in all sort of weird and wacky ways, but and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. That's just the nature of interactions. But that happens with any research project. I think we have to be sort of comfortable with failure. I mean, sometimes things just don't work. People don't gel. It can happen in focus groups. It can happen when you're coding, or it can happen with grants. It's just sometimes it just doesn't quite come together, but you're learning something anyway. And I think that that willingness to be open-minded and experiment and to explore, that definitely has a place within the university. And I think it's increasingly carving out a space within the academic setting. It's always been there. The arts have always been part of the universities, of course, but I do think people are playing with this in new and interesting ways. And I think we have to, given the challenges we're facing in the contemporary era, be it transitions to cleaner energy, be it climate change or whatever. These are urgent conversations that everyone's got to collaborate. We're not going to do this and accomplish things we need to change without these sorts of collaborations and solidarity with each other. I mean, you're not going to do this in silos. We're just going to be talking across each other. All right. Well, thanks very much for joining us. And hopefully people get a feel for what arts-based research can do alongside the sciences. And there's challenges, of course, but there's also lots of promise there and lots of opportunities. And as we can see from some of the outcomes, there's been successes as well. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Alan.
Yeah, cheers, Cliff.